The Institute on Religious Life has brought you a series of taped lectures by one of today's leading theologians, Father John A. Hardin, S.J. Some of these taped lectures have proved difficult to understand because of surface or tape noise or because of some sort of outside interference. The problem of hearing and understanding is further accentuated when some of the users attempted to play the tapes on loudspeaker systems for the benefit of their communities. For this reason, it has been necessary to retape certain of these lectures to assure clarity of voice and content. In such cases, we have had to resort to a substitute voice, but we assure you that the words spoken and the ideas presented are those of Father John A. Hardin, with nothing added, nothing subtracted. The substitute voice is that of one Robert Warnock. The current lecture by Father John Hardin is Growth in the Virtue of Chastity. Most religious, I would think, would be satisfied to keep their chastity. I specify growth in chastity. Many might say that's new, but yes, I am specifically promoting growth in this virtue. The problem, I think, first of all arises from people failing to distinguish between the vow which we are to keep and the virtue that we are supposed to practice and grow in. In order to make sense in this growing in the virtue of chastity, we must distinguish three levels of this virtue, and growth should be on each level. Chastity as temperance, chastity as sacrifice, and chastity as charity. Now all three interweave and overlap, but they are not the same. First, chastity as the virtue of temperance. We have only four cardinal or moral or principal virtues: prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. Each one of these four has many subdivisions. The virtue of temperance has many subdivisions, and to mention just two: sobriety is the virtue of temperance in food and drink. Chastity is the virtue of temperance in the sex appetite. The virtue of chastity as temperance was already known to the ancients. Aristotle spoke of temperance and of chastity in controlling the sexual passions, which even the person without revelation can appreciate its need. However, Christ did many things. Now, when we speak of the revealed law, we should clarify and distinguish between two kinds of revealed law. And chastity as temperance is a law. It is part of the natural law. We should distinguish between things that God has revealed that are also known or knowable by reason, such as chastity. Chastity as temperance is knowable by reason, but there are levels to chastity that are not knowable by reason. And this is where chastity as charity and chastity as sacrifice come in. Last week, one of the women in our Sunday class gave me four pages, a transcript of a recording. This is the tape speech given to a Chicago public high school on November 16 of last year by a woman representing Secus. Not complete, but most of the text is here. Secus is an organization that is promoting sex education. I haven't, and I couldn't, over this recording, read the whole speech. You would have to erase the tape. But this is to high school sophomores. Now let me just read less than one paragraph. And I quote, "I think it is very unhealthy not to masturbate. I have a real bone to pick with the Roman Catholic Church. It is the doctrine that has created guilt, anxiety, misery in millions of children, which is totally unjustified. Anybody who punishes anybody for masturbating is guilty of child abuse. If it's religious, we cannot attack it. Yet medical professions say it is healthy, and the Roman Catholic Church creates unnecessary anxiety. We should take issue with the Roman Catholic Church with its power to create neuroses in children and make them feel guilty." End of quote. And this is the mildest paragraph of this recording. And that is chastity as temperance to millions of young people now. Well, no wonder the country is in such a mess when in one school system after another they are being fed this. And the language. I didn't think that a woman talked this way. I didn't think that a woman would dare talk this way in public. I never dreamed that a woman would seriously talk this way in order to indoctrinate the children to destroy in them every vestige of chastity. Now, the level of chastity, of temperance, in terms of growth in it. How does a person grow in the practice of chastity as temperance? Keep these three sets of actions in mind. The first thing that must be controlled is external sins against the virtue. And I am therefore practicing chastity as temperance on the lowest level when I control my sex appetite by not enjoying venereal pleasure to external actions, either with others or with myself. Second, and a deeper level, internal sins. As our faith tells us, it is not only external sins, but even internally, we can even commit grave sins by the deliberate, fully consented to indulgence of sexual pleasure where nothing is done externally. Clearly, the control of my internal impulses to keep myself out of grave sin against chastity is a deeper level, and there is growth beyond the control of the external actions. And thirdly, internal movements. Now this, for most of us, barring almost a miracle of God, is a lifetime task. I grow in my practice of chastity as temperance by not only mastering my external actions, or those internal movements, which I may not consent to without grave sin, but even those movements which are not by themselves gravely simple, but I know as a religious, I should gradually get more and more control of. On this level of controlling even the internal movements, which are not yet simple, but which can become simple, on this level, I have got to practice a lot of vigilance. I have got to be sensitive to the first risings of the sex impulse. And let me tell you this, as one who has dealt with so many souls, the sex impulse, unlike any other, works so fast that for some people, that unless they get control of it, almost from the very first rising of the passion, it will be next to impossible to control the momentum which is built up. We are not talking about the occasion of sin as yet. That comes a little later. I am just describing the three levels of self-mastery. Chastity as temperance is self-mastery of the sex impulse. There are three levels to those impulses. There are the fully consented to internal impulses, and there are the fully consented to external impulses, both of which can be grave sins. There are the internal impulses that I am careless in controlling, but if I am really growing in my virtue of chastity as temperance, I watch even things, now this is inside of me, that I know, even though maybe I may never consent fully to a sexual impulse, that it is not right for me as a religious, because it could at least be for me an occasion to sin, or because the sacrifice of celibacy is not only, and not even mainly, the pleasure of the external action. My dear friends, the greatest sacrifice of chastity is the sacrifice of the internal satisfaction. Just to be in the arms of someone whom I love, or who happens to be of the opposite sex, or there may be no particular sex arousal, to know that I am being loved, that I am being cared for, that somebody is all mine. This is the language of all the love songs of history. There is the exclusivity which husband and wife should have, and that, by the way, we should remind ourselves, is the only divinely authorized way in which sex may be enjoyed, in the embrace of marriage. So that even, for example, to have someone who is on my mind, which as a celibate I watch those internal movements, which may or may not be an occasion of sin, but I've given that up too. Now the sequence in terms of how do you do it. This is still chastity as temperance. There are four levels known to moral theology in the priceless practice of self-control. They can be summarized in four words: stimuli, images, desires, actions. One, stimuli. Two, images. Three, desires. And four, actions. We assume that a normal person, and there are very few people who cannot be sexually stimulated, it is far below 0.1% of the population. All human beings are sexually stimulated. So if I am going to begin to practice chastity as temperance, I must watch what are my sex stimuli, and here no two people are the same. What stimulates one person can leave another entirely cold. There are some stimuli that are almost universally arousing, but for all of purposes, each person, the arousal is different for a number of reasons, perhaps because of their upbringing, or perhaps because of their personal sensitivity. Many reasons. Between men and women, there is a vast difference in stimuli. In order to practice the self-mastery, I must simply watch and give up those things which I know are for me sexually arousable. That's the stimuli. Now, secondly, the images. The function of the stimuli or the stimulus is to stimulate, but its first effect is on the imagination. If then I wish to control my sex impulse, I must, as far as I can, be prudent in not being overly exposed or aroused, and then, depending on my work, there are certain employments in the religious life where there is no choice. Take the medical profession in nursing. or for a priest in dealing with all kinds of people, some people just totally lack prudence. One of the things we tell our priests in directing them to hear confessions and giving counsel, especially to women, is not to allow the women who may be in good faith, not to allow them to go into needless detail that might be too much for the priest. He is a human being. But on the second level of the images, first of all, I am prudent in not unnecessarily allowing myself to be stimulated, but then if in the ordinary course of events, either in the course of my employment or because of my temperament or even my carelessness, I am aroused, I must control that imagination. The way to control the sex imagination is to overcome pleasure with pleasure. I must make sure that my imagination is filled with pleasant, attractive, appealing emotions, feelings, and images. And if I find myself strongly aroused, that I will do something which will counteract that stimulus. A prayer is good. An aspiration is fine. But there are times when that might even reinforce the arousal. The recommendation is then to do something which is legitimate, of course, but pleasant. Something that will fill my imagination with wholesome images, good feelings, maybe good music, maybe reading something, even an adventure story. Somehow keeping myself interestingly occupied so that the sexual imagination will gradually die down. Third, desires, sexual desires. Each of these follows in logical order. I will never control my imagination unless I first watch my stimuli. And if I don't want to have sexual desires that are contrary to my state in life, I have got to control my imagination. Daydreaming, wandering, doing things that may be boring, and this can be a problem. They don't have enough that is interesting enough to occupy them. I am sure we have heard from childhood, an idle mind is the devil's workshop. So I must make sure that my mind is profitably and pleasantly occupied, but let us be clear. No matter how strong the desire, and it can be very strong, it is not a sin yet. So far from being a sin, it may be, and with God's grace it is intended, to be a source of merit. It is not that the desire is pleasant. Frankly, there would be no temptation unless they were appealing. All desires, if they are temptations, are sweet. It is not that the desire is pleasant, that the feeling is strong, that I like what I am being urged by my impulses to do. No problem, no worries, no matter how long it lasts, as long as my will remains firm. And fourthly, finally, sexual actions. What I just read a few minutes ago from this perverse woman who is perverting others. There are so many actions that are simply assumed and taken for granted. It may be for the people who are coming into the religious life that they may have to be taught that certain actions are wrong, that masturbation is wrong. It is a mortal sin if fully and deliberately indulged. That fornication. And nowadays, so many young people, as we know, do not abstain from sex activity before marriage. Now, this does not mean that we are trying to create guilt feelings in the people that enter religious communities, who may have taken for granted that what they were doing was not so bad. But this is a delicate and difficult task, I know. On the one hand, to make sure that the actions that they say they have committed were indeed grave sins, and not to cheapen or weaken because their consciences have to be borne. I never thought I would have to say this, but I think I should. I think many young people have to have their consciences formed in the matter of chastity as though they were 6 or 7 years old. They are so undeveloped in the Christian conscience. I am afraid that there are some very intelligent people whose consciences in the matter of chastity are infantile. I was at Mother Claudia's community, and the sister in charge of getting vocations said to me, "Father, we really need to get a much better training in the virtue of chastity on every level." And as I find myself telling young women that are interested even remotely in the religious life, I find myself talking to them about things that I know very little about. They need counsel. This is something I think really takes looking into. There can be no chastity of sacrifice unless there has first been chastity of temperance, nor of love unless there has been sacrifice. God's grace is manifest in many aspects of the religious life, but I doubt if there is any aspect in which God's grace is more famously active than in the practice of chastity. It is the kind of witness that everyone understands. Once they make sure we are chaste, they may, in spite of themselves, be willing to admit God must be active. Human nature is not naturally chaste. Man is naturally unchaste. There are two among the seven, two fundamental capital sins. They are pride and lust. There are two fundamental virtues in Christian morality, and they are humility and chastity. And growth in chastity, about which we are talking, should be on all three levels. And I might add, on each level, in sequence. You know, even a semester course in moral theology, which would involve not necessarily all the details that are necessary for married people, but certain things everyone should know about chastity on a very high level spiritually, but nevertheless factually. Take the religious textbooks, and I've been working with some for 10 years. I keep telling the sisters who are writing the texts, and I go over what they write. I can't exactly blame them, but I have to bring it to their attention. Sisters, these children are living in the world, and in the upper grades, even at a grammar school, 6th, 7th, 8th grades, these youngsters, they know it all. I don't mean in the way that they should, but you know what I mean. So that a certain amount of realism, and this is a hard one, because on the one hand, we are religious, for whom chastity is a great virtue, a beautiful virtue. But on the other hand, if we are going to deal with others, we have to know whether we like it or not, how to deal with others. For anyone that is in formation, in training others, in preparing others, we simply must know as much as the opportunities available, as much as the opportunities can afford, to know about chastity and the breaches of chastity in modern society. Otherwise, we can inherit some major problems. and later on, the supervision doesn't even dream or comprehend what the problem is, because the person doesn't know himself or herself. Our previous Father General, Father Jansen, a Belgian, this may be 15 years ago, when he was urging the whole order to get hold of itself and to be careful about what is going on, already the defections had become alarming among the Jesuits. Few people know, but I can affirm factually, as he did, the main reason for defection in the religious life is failure in chastity. A large statement. We have a question here about sex education in the second and third grades, given under the guise of physical science or hygiene. No knowledge on the part of the parents that this is being taught. The question is rapidly becoming this: to what extent can the apostolic community, which we call ourselves, to what extent can it continue their work in the apostolate and do the work that needs to be done by religious who are, on the one hand, being called to reach the heights of our profession, to practice angelic chastity, and at the same time be knowledgeable, be factually informed, and be able to help? All I know is you don't deal with sexual problems without paying for it. Not easy dealing with these things, no matter what your state of life, bishop, priest, or religious. Yet if we are going to help others, we must be able, first of all, to inform them. But we must also, and this is most difficult, we must be able to deal with others without being spoiled ourselves. Even to read a book on these things, all I can tell you, I've read things, I've had to read things, I would rather have died. I mean it. I would rather have died rather than read, except I was convinced under God that it was necessary for the good of souls. And we cannot go into protective custody. Agreed, it is a question of how much, and especially, most especially, how close, how very close we must be with God, how united you have to be with Him in order to maintain one's own chastity while helping others overcome their unchastity. Now, to return to this matter of the sequence of self-control in 8 steps. 1, external objects. 2, sensation. 3, thought. 4, desire. 5, feeling. 6, action. 7, habit. And 8, one's character. The first, by external objects, we mean such stimulus. There are things outside of us over which the most important are people that are sexually stimulating. If the person wants to grow in the practice of chastity as temperance, he or she has first to be careful about what external stimulating objects enter their lives. One of the main reasons for a religious vocation is to get control over these stimuli, reduce their number, or their frequency, and their ferocity. Among the necessary things, modest dress, modest behavior. Which reminds me, speaking of the habit, a young priest from India, reflecting on Mother Teresa and the Sisters of Charity, talking to me here one day at noontime, said, but Mother Teresa, she just wears a sari, the same dress as all Indian women. Yes, I said, but this same sari is being worn by her nuns in 30 different countries. Now, obviously, this is a modest dress, and it presents a modest figure, which coupled with a modest behavior has great impact. The last thing a person expects when they enter the religious life is to be sexually stimulating. Secondly, I must watch the sensations which I experience. Here you look to the stimuli. No two people are quite the same. Some people are more easily aroused than others. After 30 years in the priesthood, take this as an infallible truth. There is no such thing as not being sexually stimulating. Given certain circumstances, a sensation will be aroused. Third, once I am aroused, there is no sin in the arousal, since I am a rational being. I am not a mere animal. I am a rational animal. The sensation enters my mind. I become aware of it. And just as I am to control my sensations, so I am to control my thoughts. Sin is not in the sensation. Sin is what I do with that sensation. A sensation gives me certain kinds of thoughts, which I either control or I will never preserve my chastity. Fourth, every thought tends to become a desire. There are no thoughts that more spontaneously become desires than sexual thoughts. The nearest thing to a split second is the time it takes for a sexual thought to become a sexual desire. The desire is not yet the sin, but these things can move in lightning speed. The desire is there. Once the person realizes that these are not the desires he should have, then I simply must turn off my desire. And how do you do that? By a contrary desire. You counteract sinful desires by pleasant, good desires. We all like to have a pleasant thought. We like to have pleasant desires. Except in this case, a pleasant desire is sinful. Telling myself I don't want it, as we know, reality smiles at logic. So I don't want the desire. So what? It's there. Saying you don't want it, can't put it away. The Church's wisdom over the centuries has found the most effective ways of countering sinful desires. And for us religious, all sexual desires are a temptation to sin, because we are supposed to have given up all deliberate sexual experience. This is the high price tag of religious chastity. The thing to do is to cultivate and have ready at hand pleasant things that I will be thinking about that will stimulate good desires, things that I like. Like what? Well, perhaps reading an adventure story, a murder mystery, listening to certain good music. The pleasant things that will stimulate good desires. Number five is feeling. Feelings are in the body, all right, but more in the emotions. We sometimes call them interior or inner sensations. When they are aroused, and I realize the desire I have is one that I have no right to, again, now, there are ways. and I am not discouraging that of practicing mortification by imposing unpleasant feelings on myself to merit the grace I need to control the sinful temptations. But when I am under a barrage of sinful feelings, as one who has counseled many people, these unpleasant mortifications are perhaps not the best thing to do. Do something pleasant that you like to do so that you will overcome pleasure with pleasure. Again, what kind? Pleasant but virtuous pleasure, overcoming pleasant but sinful pleasure. Now, this is not the same thing as self-indulgence. It is how to cope with these sexual feelings and how to tell others to cope with them. And what people might think, especially young ones that have just read a book, you know, it tells them that every saint was mortified. They want to become saints, so they mortify themselves. And they really do it. Loss of weight, denying themselves all sorts of amenities. And then they tell me, "Father, I don't know what happened to me. I am mortifying myself to death, and I have never had more trouble with my chastity." Wisdom, prudence, a certain amount of emotional satisfaction is necessary for sanctity. Otherwise, nature might avenge herself, and the poor soul doesn't know what's happening. I am not talking about self-indulgence, but there must be a certain amount of emotional pleasure. You know, among St. Ignatius' published writings, some of the strongest that he wrote were to the cooks in our newly found houses who were not preparing good meals. Now, isn't that amazing? This is a great mystic. Nature is very subtle, and it tends to compensate when a person jumps ahead of his grace or anticipates grace or acts imprudently. Nature tends to compensate by sexual arousal because there is not enough sound and salutary emotional satisfaction. Clearly we can sin, and people should be taught this, that they can sin, as already discussed in part one, by an injudicious exposure to sex stimuli, because I am tempting Providence. You know, when I see some of the magazines and newspapers that come into religious houses, and I've seen religious reading them, and not for professional reasons, some of these publications, well, is it any wonder that religious life is in trouble? But it is especially in actions. By that time, if the person has not exercised control, sin steps in. You know, this whole subject is worth two semesters of study. There are so many facets, spiritually, morally, psychologically, a lot to learn. And depending on the person's own background, no two people entering the religious life come with the same sexual background. And by now, I suppose you are finding out that not a few have had quite a sex life before they became religious. That is one reason why the church strongly discourages using the word virginity in speaking of consecrated chastity. If you do use the term, make sure that it is understood that it does not mean a person who has lost his or her chastity before becoming a religious cannot live a very holy life, a very holy life of consecrated chastity. But specifically, it means that a person then does something consciously and more or less deliberately. Note my language. More or less deliberately. That will either bring the arousal, which by that time has already been experienced to its fulfillment, or to bring it about, either to stimulate or to consummate regarding sinful actions against chastity. These are the two words we use in theology. Stimulate, consummate. A person either stimulates or does something deliberately in order to have sexual experience to which, as a religious, he or she has no right. Or if already stimulated through imprudence or neglect, or just the onslaught of passion. And remember, the passion can be violent without being sinful. Then the other option, which becomes sinful, is if I do something no longer to stimulate, because we are assuming there has already been stimulation, but to consummate, to experience orgasm or its equivalent. Let me add one more word here, especially in the counseling of others. Be sure the person who admits to sinful actions against chastity was fully aware and fully awake at the time the action was performed. Actions then performed, surely in sleep, or when not yet fully awake, are a sign there has not been at least full consent, which in this matter is crucial. And in general, we tell our priests, if a person honestly is not absolutely sure whether they have fully consented, they should always give themselves the benefit of the doubt. Get the adverb, always. That is the church's teaching, that there has not been full consent, therefore the matter is not necessarily to be confessed.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.